Morning, Steve. How are you doing?
Okay. This will work out fine. Talked earlier with Don Lupo. We got our first glance at the Woodbine action, the Queen's Plate, and the three major stakes. They tie in with the 8th and the 9th at Belmont for this week's pick five. So you want to do them in order, or do you want to? How do you want to handle it?
Yeah, we could talk about Belmont first, and then switch over to Woodbine. I mean, I think as far as the two stake races go, or the two races at Belmont go, obviously Dunbar Road is going to be the focus of a great deal of attention, and the Mother Goose clearly coming off that prep win that was rather facile. I think the expectation is that Dunbar Road is going to advance to be a Coaching Club American Oaks and or Alabama type of horse. Looks like one that will really benefit from the added ground, and suddenly, in a way, Chad Brown seems to have the two best female three-year-olds alive right now between he and Guarana, or at least two of the best ones, with Serengeti Empress also in the mix. But I would imagine the majority of people are going to single Dunbar Road. I could see some support potentially for a horse like maybe Wings of Dawn trying dirt for the first time. It is a pretty dirt-oriented pedigree. I will say that I thought Safta's maiden win last time out was pretty impressive. She was up and on top of a very fast pace and ended up going on with it. However, you do have to kind of at least acknowledge to an extent that Safta's taken a big step forward on wet tracks in her last two starts. So we'll see if she does so once now back on a dry surface, because it does look like there won't be any issue with weather. So I think it's safe to say that the majority of action, like I said, is going to be on Dunbar Road, looking to get it done in her now returning to graded state company. The Funny Money Honey is going to be a pretty big favorite in the last as well. This did not look like a race that was overly competitive. We talked on Wednesday with the people who were also playing the pick six about the race that Galadriel's Light won last time, and My First Gal did come out of it to win, but that did look like a bit of a subpar, a maiden 40, and that was a New York bred race, of course, whereas Get Mother of Rose comes out of a much stronger open maiden 40, where she was on top of a fast pace again and was able to get the job done. It's going to be important over the next couple of days to really watch the turf courses at Belmont, because this little spat of warmer weather has made them both firm up quite a bit, and speed does have a decided advantage on those turf courses when things get super firm. So we'll see if that ends up being the case over the next couple of days. That would certainly benefit a horse like Get Mother of Rose. It would also probably make you want to at least consider throwing in Brass Ring, because Brass Ring's been involved in some really crazy paces in her last few starts. I don't know if she's quite good enough to get the job done setting a pace like that, or having to stave off Get Mother of Rose and maybe a couple of others early, but there's no doubt that she's got a lot of early zip. And so if you have any belief that things might be tilted in the direction of a speed horse, I think she's the one that you'd probably want to focus on. There's no question that this sequence is fun because of Woodbine, with just three pretty competitive races, ending with that Queen's Plate that, I mean, every year we talk about what a tremendous betting opportunity the Queen's Plate is, and I don't think this year is any different. As far as the Dance Smartly, which is the first leg of this wager and the first of the three races from Woodbine, it's really a matter of what you're going to do with Holy Helena, who had a trip last time in New York and was probably never going to be much better than third behind Homerique in Competition of Ideas, and now goes second off a short layoff for Jimmy Jerkins, going up to Woodbine for an engagement in this race again, where she came up a little bit short last year, running third behind Santa Monica and in Flexibility. The mile and a quarter is really ideal for her, I believe, and I would like to think she's a little bit better horse this year than she was last year. I don't know if that's necessarily true based on her speed figures, but I do think she ran well in her most recent start without really a great pace set up, and I think she's positioned well in this spot. Starship Jubilee is the horse to beat. There's no doubt about it. Her body of work at Woodbine's been very, very strong, and she was involved in a fast pace in this race last year before they started to change tactics with her by dropping her in class and then taking her back to make one run in the Canadian, which she upset at a little over 11-1. The Nassau was a strong effort for her. I think it proves that she's right back in top form, and she'll certainly be, I think, in many ways the horse to beat. And you're going to have to use Rock My Love. So I don't have much of an opinion beyond those three favorites, but Rock My Love competed in some pretty strong mile-plus races overseas, now gets into the care of Jonathan Thomas, looks to be training pretty well, and obviously has some running lines that are very, very strong from over there. The Highlander is an excellent race, and I think there's no question the Caribou Club is the horse to beat. There are a few, I think, who will scrimmage in the early stages, and that should help his cause. I do think in many ways you want to give Extravagant Kid a little bit of an extra look, because if a horse is able to get loose in here, I think it would be him. I think he's a little bit quicker than Super Smart, and there's really not a proven front-running type other than that. White Flag comes back off a layoff after setting a fast pace in the tropical turf, and I think he's worthy of inclusion based on that 6-furlong win at Aqueduct last fall. So this is another leg where you might not have to stretch all that much. El Tormenta is an interesting horse for many reasons, including that win in the Connaught Cup last time where he was pretty close to the pace. Pace was very slow in there, and at least to the opening quarter, they sped it up as it went on. But I thought El Tormenta really proved that he's back to that good form that he showed as a 3-year-old. And then, I mean, you could certainly weigh in. And of course, Yorkton is going to be a part of that pace as well. I completely left him out. But I do think that that doesn't really harm any of the causes of horses like Extravagant Kid, who have speed as well. The Queen's Plate is an absolute skullbuster, as it always is. I think Skywire is the best horse in the race. And I think the big step forward he's taken since he got back to Canada earlier in the Woodbine meet really shows that. And having swapped decisions with Global Access in open company races, one of which he really buried a horse like Federal Law, shows the quality that he has. I have no reason to think that the 1.25 mile is going to be a problem for him. And I think that of he and AZ's Flatter, I'm a little bit more inclined to take Skywire. But obviously, you're using both of these two primarily in any kind of multi-race bet. And I think from there, you're pretty much using everybody else. Maybe One Bad Boy as an A also. Everybody else just looks like a backup to me.
Interesting. And, you know, the filly down inside should get a tremendous trip. What are your thoughts about the where to go? Oh, my gosh. The
Aspis. Desert Ride.
Desert Ride. Yeah, I think you got to respect the Tone Broke is the interesting oddball.
Yeah, it's funny. They've certainly tried some different things with Tone Broke and may not have thought off the bat that they were going to end up here. This certainly feels like a horse that will have no issue whatsoever with extra ground. We all, I guess, remember that synthetics were sort of a nightmare for Steve Asmussen. And you don't want to hang your hat on that too much, but it certainly matters. And this is a horse that, I guess, looked like he was a little bit more comfortable being back here in America last time, running a good second behind King for a Day. I think that now, fast forward 7 weeks or so, that second behind King for a Day looks a little bit more impressive. So I think you have to include him as a backup. I think he'll probably be a little bit overbet with that good most recent running line, and I think the surface concern is a bit of an issue. But, you know, you're talking about a race where I think the separation between Skywire and AV's Flatter and then everybody else is really not so vast that you can say, oh, you don't really want to entertain any alternatives. I'm just more inclined to make all of those alternatives backups, with the exception of maybe One Bad Boy. And I think there might be some people who want to elevate Tone Broke a little bit. They just look to me like horses that are maybe a little bit less likely to win, and ones that you'd probably want to use maybe in a B or a C position.
Now, and the one thing I hadn't done that I just was kind of poking through here, looking at Mendocino Beano, the dam, and what kind of a record that she had compiled, both as a runner and she had tried the all weather just once herself up there, and actually she placed them. Her black type came from the Ontario Colleen. But, you know, Smart Strike, I thought between Smart Strike and Broken Vow, there was enough in there to kind of indicate there might be some, you know, some ability. You do have the sibling, Stallion Heiress, the exchange rate that was okay on turf. All three wins actually came on turf, and two of them at Fairgrounds, and actually was third in the Plenty of Grace last year, as it happens, Stallion Heiress. So there's a little hint, you know, that might take to the surface.
Yeah, Conquest Fleet Feet, I think, is also a sibling who's staked placed at at Woodbine. So, yeah, there's a little bit of belief to it. I'm sure Broken Vow's been a perfectly fine 15%. Synthetic stallion. Right, yeah, again, a horse that's been pretty productive on any surface. So, yeah, I think with a turf-inclined pedigree, can't be too surprised if this horse outperforms expectations. And, again, the distance looks like it'll be no issue whatsoever. I guess we probably shouldn't talk about this race entirely without at least mentioning the winner of the plate trial, a Pay for Peace, who came from a little bit off a pretty strong pace that day and got the job done at almost 20-1 and has run well, I think well enough in the past to really be given a little bit of consideration. He's obviously going to have to take another pretty big step forward in order to get the job done in here, but class-wise, it was a nice drop-off coming from open company, older optional claiming races to get into that plate trial, and he really benefited, I think, from the way things unfolded. Now, he was helped, of course, by the pace that Federal Law was a part of, and it'll be interesting to see if Federal Law is ridden in a similar fashion this time around. Jamie Spencer coming in to get the ride for Qatar Racing Limited, given that he's one of their regulars. And we'll see if he's as inclined to take this horse to the front end as some of his previous riders have been, because one thing that this race is not really teeming with is early speed. And I think that could, if we see Spencer get a little conservative with Federal Law, that will likely put Flavian Pratt in a very favorable position with One Bad Boy, who is clearly a horse with a tremendous amount of early speed. The pace that he was a part of in his maiden win two back at Santa Anita was insane. And he came back and was involved in a very strong pace last time in the Alcatraz, before weakening a little bit late, but this looks like a horse that really could be in an advantageous spot dictating terms if Federal Law is conservatively ridden. So we'll see. One thing that I like about Skywire and Avi's Flat are both, of course, is that they are not slow by any means, and they can be up and on top of that pace if need be, which could certainly help their cause.
Well, the sequence goes with the Dance Smartly, the Highlander, then the Mother Goose, then the Queen's Plate, and then that starter allowance. The ninth at Belmont. It starts at 4:18 tomorrow, the cross country pick five. And Nick, before we go, you got about a minute or so. Your impressions yesterday of the follow up performance, looking at Bikinis for Chad Brown and Long Lake and partners, including Tom Coleman and Sal Kumin, a nice, fun group. This performance brought back a 95 buyer, the follow-up to the debut win, and looks like he'll stretch out, and they've got, I think, some aggressive plans for him this summer.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine he'll run in the Curlin and then the Travers.
That sounds right.
Yeah, kind of, the backdoor route to the Travers. I mean, people that probably weren't following Aqueduct much during the winter, I can assure you, Not That Brady's a good horse.
Yep.
So beating Not That Brady by no means is something to scoff at. And looking at Bikinis, looked like one that was really, capable of more off of that big maiden win. So we'll see, how he performs in his next outing. There's no question he'll stretch out more, and I think two turns won't be an issue. So it's a little bit like 16 and 17, where we're kind of waiting for a three-year-old to sort of move forward and pop up that maybe is slightly interesting or at this point somewhat unseen. And I think looking at Bikinis now joins a group that includes a horse like Highest Honors that I think we'll see in stakes company pretty soon as the type that can be maybe a little bit of a second-half star, because there's been a lot of attrition amongst what we saw early on. And, you know, I think that the remainder of the year for this crop will largely hinge on how Game Winner and Omaha Beach come back, and if we see anything out of Maximum Security in terms of the horses that we know. Otherwise, it's all going to be new faces or horses that maybe have not had some of those big graded stakes engagements up to this point.
Nick Tamaro, I appreciate it. NTAM1215. Nick, have a terrific fourth. You got plans next week? You got something nice lined up?
Nothing crazy.
All right. Well, then we'll talk to you for
plenty of stakes.
Well, plenty of action leading in to our return. How about Saratoga opening on the 11th? When's the first time we're going to see you up here?
Good question. I'm going to Del Mar at the end of July, so I'm trying to figure it out exactly when, but it looks like Travers, if not sooner.
Oh, all right. Well, Travers is a ways off. All right. Either way, you will help us with some Saratoga winners with the meet starting 2 weeks from yesterday. Nick, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve. Have a great weekend.
Nick Tamaro, folks, and Tam, 1215. We're going to stay, and now we got a chance for a much-anticipated visit. I'm saddened that it takes Suffolk leaving the landscape to make it happen, but Don Winfrey joins us, an absolute horseman legend. Don, good morning. Yep, there we go.
Hey.
Don Winfrey, good morning.
Hi, Steve. Hadn't spoke to you since Derby week. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm heading over to East Boston, the stomping grounds, and we weren't going to do this without a visit from you.
I couldn't hear you, Steve.
Well, we didn't want to let this go by, Don, without having a couple of stories and a couple of reminiscences of Suffolk, you know, before it leaves the scene. Yeah. Don, you having trouble hearing us?
I got you now.
There we go. All right. No, Don, I didn't want to talk about Suffolk and leave you out of this. You know, you're a New England legend, not just New England, but you know what is this kind of a situation? You know, Suffolk leaving the scene. What does it mean to you?
Oh, I just hate to see it, Steve. I've looked at, you know, 9 or 10 racetracks all go to their demise one after another up there. And when I started, I mean, I got black and white pictures from rubbing horses and training horses in Rhode Island or Boston or Rockingham when the whole grandstand was full of people. And it's just a shame, you know. I hate to see it, but I'm at the other end of the rainbow now, so nothing's going to change, you know.
Where did you grow up? In what proximity to the track?
I grew up in Pawtucket, Rhode Island.
So you had Gansett and Lincoln as
a
kid.
We had two good racetracks, Steve, within probably 10 miles of each other.
And how was the circuit? How did the circuit work in that era?
Well, when the circuit was good, it started in Rhode Island. They'd alternate Rhode Island. Well, it would always start at Lincoln, then Suffolk, then Rock, then Gansett. And it worked well for, you know, for 50 years because all the same big outfits would end up, but where there were different states controlling it, then Rhode Island or whoever else, I don't know. I don't know the politics. Rhode Island ended up running against Suffolk and Rock, and that kind of watered things down. That was the start of watering, you know, the demise, really. I mean, it thinned things out. When I was a kid, not a kid, but I mean, when I was rubbing horses and first started training, if you had a horse good enough in Rhode Island, you could bring the Suffolk to run. You were kind of going from AAA ball to the majors. And I can remember thinking, man, I'm going to Suffolk. I'm going to run. I got a shot in here. And little by little, you know, just like the way the whole industry is going, everything, big fish are eating little fish. But I cannot believe that New England racing is dead because they had the best racing fans in the country at one time. You could go to a bar room, nobody's talking about baseball or football, talking about the races. And I can remember the Record American with the Boston paper. It had come out with not one handicapper's graded entries for the day. It had Bob Waldo and Dave Wilson with their selections and the reasons. And it's just hard to fathom how it's just went away.
Well, and, you know, the uncertainty about what lies ahead. How did you get on the racetrack?
Oh, well, I grew up probably 3 miles from Gansett, 4 miles from Gansett, and I had got a job walking hots one summer, which dollar a head back then with Butch Lanzini. His dad trained up there, John Lanzini, and Butch, I went to school with Butch, and we'd go walk hots. And got in my blood. And, I mean, one of the first guys I ever met on the racetrack, I had to hitchhike to Gansett, and I'd stop and get coffee, and Len Whiten was just, I think maybe he just got out the Army, but he'd stop in the same place for coffee, and he had seen me hitchhiking, and he said, "I'll give you a ride." And we ended up friends till his dying day, and still my dear friend. And just started, you know, walking horses, rubbing horses. Ended up working on a starting gate feed truck, like a lot of guys did up there in New England. Back then, you didn't have these. You might have had two or three outfits had 30, 40 horses, and everything else was 6 horses, 4 horses, 10 horses. And it was a whole lot different atmosphere, a whole lot different business. But I learned from the bottom to the top and was very successful after I ran into a friend of mine in when I moved to Suffolk from Rhode Island. A friend of mine introduced me to Jim Devaney, and it was a perfect marriage for a long, long time. I mean, we did very well. Jim was leading owner here. In fact, Ken Ramsey, I think, broke his record as leading owner titles. And we did it with, you know, one barn and 24 horses, not 100 horses. But that's the change of the business. I mean, that's the demise of a lot of these racetracks is mega outfits have, and I'm not knocking them guys. I don't blame them a bit, but you had a whole lot more luck filling races and putting up more competitive fields when all the horses weren't in the same, you know, 3 or 4 places.
No doubt. And those mom and pop and small outfits. And you know, one thing that came up yesterday, T.D. Thornton talked about his dad, Paul, you know, who was a teacher. he was basically a part-time horseman and a good one. You know, the most recent I can think of that you know, was like that. You had, oh, my gosh, McCarthy that had general quarters, but also Joe Aquilino for many years was a fireman and he was training in New York. But that era, you know, has really disappeared, largely. I mean, when did you sort of leave New England? Because there's so many guys, it seems, Don, that you know, you think about Ned Allard and Bobby DeBona and the Claseruses and, you know, there's so many that kind of scattered. John Rigottieri, Asimakopoulos. I mean, there were so many great horsemen.
Len Whiting, Billy
Lynn
Perry.
Whiting.
I mean, you can go down. I can't name them all. Vinny Blangs. I mean, Vinny, I worked for Vinny years ago when I was a kid. Vinny was as good a horseman as there is in the country. You know, I mean, it was just the changing of the guard, Steve. And I got lucky. I had done very well in Rhode Island with my own. I had a small stable, 5, 6 horses, but win at a high rate. And then I had some issues, and I had to I left Rhode Island. I went to Boston. I started back with a couple of horses again. And a friend of mine introduced me to Jim Devaney. And it was a perfect marriage for 30-some years. I mean, we started, he said he had had some horses with another trainer. And he wanted to get a couple of horses to run in New England. I bought a couple of horses off of Len Whiting. And we'd done well with him. And from there, and Jim had seen the writing on the wall a long time ago, reclaiming horses. Up in them days, there was not much money involved, and he wanted to get into the young horses. And we started buying some yearlings, basically off a farm at first. J.R. Bettis with Westwind Farms in Bowling Green. And one of the first horses I bought, and she had some infirmities that I didn't even see, the filly named No Joke. And she ended up champion filly in New England that year. And I, in this day and age, because now I'm smart, I wouldn't have even run her, but I took a three-year-old filly and I run her in Belmont against older fillies and mares in an overnight handicap, and she won easy. And then the phone was ringing off the hook. But we kind of sold. We developed young. After that, we developed young horses to resell them, and we had a lot of good horses in 30-some years. Laser Show came later. Yeah, we bought her. Frank Smith and I bought her it. I think Fassie Tipton. Put not a whole lot of money, and she won just under $1 million sprinting in the 80s with a filly. I had to run her against colts all the time, but that was the only way you could get paid. But she was a great filly, had a lot of issues, and could never make the Breeders' Cup sprint, which back then there wasn't a classification for Breeders' Cup fillies.
Right, not for a long time.
And she had beat, one year we beat Smile at Philadelphia in his next start. He won the Breeders' Cup sprint. And the next year, we beat Very Subtle at Arlington Park. And her next start, she won the Breeders' Cup sprint. But like I say, Laser Show had a lot of issues, and I couldn't get her that far down the year. I wouldn't run her a lot, but we had some good horses that we never were six-figure buyers, you know. And our basic thing was, Frank Smith in South Carolina, and I would get them ready and make them show good early and resell and rebuy, and it worked well for a long time, Steve. Long time, you know.
And yeah, and when you say, you know, for those that are listening and you hear the name Frank Smith, you heard from Frank earlier this year, Gory Smith, Hammy Smith's brother. And, you know, you've got so many of these overlap stories, Don, and it's one of the reasons I wanted to get you on. You talk about Westwinds in Bowling Green. You stunned me when we were at Churchill, and the word came out about the Hall of Fame horses, and we were all excited about My Juliet for Tony Black, and right. Westwind bred her, and you said you got her foisted out from under you. You could have taken her.
No, I didn't get her hoisted. I passed on.
You passed.
So I can add that to my credentials. But I bought a lot of good ones. She. Westwind Farm basically got Jim Devaney in the business because we bought a lot of other good ones that, for no money, we'd buy a whole truck full of Grand Revivals, Coupon Ray, put the coupons his brother. But that's how it goes. I mean, you can't, sometimes you get too fussy in this business. Steve, you think you know too much. You know, you find a flaw and, you pass on a horse. Everybody that's ever bought yearlings has passed on a good horse.
Well, you know, you talk about laser show and, you know, and just missing. You just missed the winning the Suffolk sprint handicap when it was a grade three. Play the King, that the really nice Play the King.
It was John Tamaro's horse, King Haven Farms. I remember it well.
Unbelievable.
And that was a colt. I mean, but she beat a lot of good, like I said, she beat a lot of good colts because that was the only place there was any money. I mean, well, she won just shy of $1 million in the 80s. The Philly Sprint was kind of hard to do.
Well, and I'm looking at names of the winners of just that race from the mid-80s, and Ron Dandy, Concord Bound with Carl Gambardella aboard. Vinnie Blang's won with Antley, Digging Ditches. Eddie Coletti won a couple of them. Talk about the people, you know, Don, that you came up with, raced against at Suffolk, and you know, ended up all over the industry.
There's too many to name. There were so many good horsemen come out of New England. And there were so many of them stayed there. I mean, just because of family or just for convenience. But when Jim Devaney, when we started off doing good, it was time we had to move because he was investing money. And I ended up in Kentucky, and it was the best thing I ever did. I mean, I've been leading trainer here a couple of times years ago, and I'm still here clocking horses. But there's, like I say, there's so many good jocks and Stuart Elliott, Edgar Prado, just a couple of two to come off the top of my head that come out of Boston. Vinny brought Edgar Prado out of Boston. Vinny, I worked for Vinny a little bit. He was a top horseman. There were a lot of guys that, you know, lived and died horses, but it's just sad, Steve. You know, I wrote a list down of the tracks that are closed up there, and every one of them I can look at old Winner's Circle pictures, and the whole grandstand was full of people, you know, behind your Winner's Circle picture.
Sure.
And now, even here at Churchill, if it's not a big, big day, there's not a crowd in the grandstand. And a lot of it, I think technology and OTB and everything to a certain extent has kind of bit the business in the ass as far as horse racing, you know. And I hate to say it, but I'm kind of glad I'm on the way up because it's not. I thought my son's a master electrician in New Orleans. He was my assistant for years. And I told him, you gotta jump off the ship. This ain't going to float no more.
Mm. Well, there's still ways to enjoy it when it comes to the windows. You certainly have no shortage, Donna, of stories. I don't know how many of them you can tell here. Frankly, I appreciate that the statute of limitations is probably over on a few fun stories, but
Steve, I'm gonna say this, Steve. I never did anything illegal. I took advantage of situations to set up a bet for whoever I was working for, but I never was involved, and I was right in the middle of a whole bunch of it up there years ago where there were things going on, and I have never done anything that I'm ashamed of doing. I mean, I took pride in taking advantage of a horse pulling up with something wrong and taking 3 or 4 months off and getting him ready and taking him somewhere else and making a good bet on him. But that's a whole lot. I mean, that's the way I learned from the guys I learned from.
Sure, of course.
Mean, as far as doing anything illegal, I could take a polygraph.
Atta boy, I love
and
it.
And I do like the bet. That's why I'm still getting up 7 days a week at 4:30 to go sit upstairs and clock horses, as you know.
Absolutely, and still getting some licks in, and obviously we invoked you a little bit with Hog Creek Hustle, and something tells me it's going to take a while for that money to get spent.
Well, I can spend it.
You can spend it with the best of them.
I'm safe for the whole connection. They're all good friends of mine. And Patty Tipton picked the horse out of the catalog. And Greg Foley was over there. Vicky's brother was over there the day before the horse was going to sell. And Greg said, you need to come and look at this horse. And we all went and looked at him. And everybody liked him, and I knew he'd bring more than what they priced him at just because it was a weekday in the sale and there weren't many individuals in the sale that anybody would spend any money on. And I'm so glad they got him bought. And it's so good to see some little people in this business, Steve, because the days, and you know, there's not many times it happens where a little guy jumps in and buys one horse, and it turns out a grade one winner. I mean, yeah. And I'm tickled to death for the whole bunch of them.
Well, you helped me get just even aware, really, of his potential when I walked into Loise's by the track when I was in town for the Risen Star, and you and Vicky Foley were having lunch up at the bar at the Loise's, and I sidled
La Uza.
Up.
La Uza.
Well, I'm not. I can't give it the full New Orleans effect, but. That was special, and so it kind of put me in on the ground floor with Hog Creek, and I kind of botched, to be honest, I botched it when it came to the big bet. I didn't think he could win that, Don. I got to be honest. I just didn't think,
Big John didn't think so either, but I thought it was a perfect storm of speed, and the Belmont, the big turn where being outside is not that big a deal. If you do it at the right time, and Corey rode a perfect race on him.
Yeah, he did. He sure did. No, it was wonderful. It was wonderful to be there. And before you go, speaking of missing bets, I'm instructed to have you tell everybody the Merrill story about when he didn't bet for the owner.
Oh Lord, you're gonna get me in big trouble. They're having his birthday party at 12:30 upstairs in the gold room, and I'm not gonna be able to go. But Merrill had an owner. I'm not gonna mention his name, and I'm not gonna mention, well, the horse's name was Tamarack something, Tribute or Ruler. And Merrill was supposed to make a pretty good across the butt bet on the horse. Across the board bet on the horse for the owner, and he forgot. And the horse won, carried the horse out the whole length of the stretch. And Merrill was down in the winner's circle hollering. We were at Sportsman's Park. We were living together, Merrill and I. And Merrill was down in the winner's circle hollering, take him down. Take him down. They left. But that's another story. Mark Dickett rode the horse.
What did it cost Merrill? How much? How do you have go in his pocket for?
Cost him a brand new Chevrolet truck that he had just bought that he had to sell to somebody to pay his bet. And he owned up and he rode back and forth to the track with me the rest of the meet.
Well, there's a story that we're going to have to get to you at some point about having to hustle out of the winner's circle, and there's any number of great Don Winfrey stories, and they've become like those legends, like Aesop's fables involving you.
Oh, there's a little embellishment, Steve, but most of them are basically true.
Exactly.
But you know what? when you get 71, Steve, that's what it gets down to. You remember all the good fun. And I didn't have any more fun than anywhere at Suffolk Down. I mean, I hate to see it. I mean, and I wasn't always plush up there. But
yeah. Well, it's going to be a celebration, Don, and your name will be brought up along with so many other great New Englanders that passed through and made it, you know, made the mark on the history.
So many
good
guys come out of there, Steve. You know,
no doubt, and
so many good.
I appreciate the opportunity, Don.
And Suffolk, at one time, you could be at Green Mountain, Lincoln, or Gansett. And if you had a good enough horse to take the Suffolk, you thought you made the majors. And it was the majors. I remember Alan Jerkins bringing horses in there, Canal and those kind of horses for Hobo Farms. It was not a minor league track. It was a major league track. But progress goes on. You know, I know where the property is. The property you can probably sell by the inch. And it's just the way it is.
Well, it's going to be celebrated this weekend. We've been celebrating it the last couple of days, and I wasn't going to do it without you. Don, thank you so much.
Go get your roast beef sandwich at Kelly's, Steve.
Now you're talking. I love it. We can't go to Hilltop, though. Can't go to the Hilltop anymore, right?
Like Hilltop. They say in New Orleans, it ain't there no more.
Exactly. That's right. But I love it. Up the Linway. That's what we'll do. I love it. Don Winfrey, everybody, and more appreciation coming for Suffolk Downs. Jessica Chappell's going to join us and more, and we'll stay right here. We got too much to do and only 40 minutes left this morning. And standing by in Toronto, back up to TO we go. And Ed DeRosa, who's back for another Queen's plate. How many plates is this for you, Ed?
This is my third plate.
That's what I thought. I thought two or three, yeah.
Third
nice.
Plate, and I think seventh or eighth visit to Woodbine.
Well, it's a wonderful place. So we talked to Don Lupel earlier this morning, and they certainly put together, it's a tremendous show, and the facility, you know, undoubtedly will be thronged. I've only hit Woodbine Mile Day, and that was terrific. So Plate Day, you know, takes it even up a notch. Talk a little bit about going into the weekend, and then we'll get some ideas here about what you fancy.
Yeah, well, speaking of fancy, yeah, if you like pomp and circumstance, Queen's Plate, your opportunity to see it North America. So always looking forward to the parade and the show they put on, as you said. But, yeah, head on a swivel, Steve, on Saturday. 13 race card at Woodbine, 12 race card at Churchill. Of course, the back half of that card, the mandatory payout pick six, which if it does not get hit today, we'll have a $300,000 plus carryover. So looking forward to digging into that among all the stakes and Queen's Plate action at Woodbine, where that 13 race card has four pick five opportunities, which I think is the most pick fives I can remember on a card. So the heavy action for sure, but not a lot of favorites I love, so hopefully it can be a big day.
Well, any quick hits before we talk Woodbine? Anything from Churchill?
Yeah, Churchill, real quick, the sequence starts off with a pretty challenging allowance race, and Rise the Guy is definitely going to be a guy on virtually all of my tickets. Hasn't gotten a chance to try turf yet, but unquestionably, on paper anyway, the fastest in the field, and I have a little optimism that turf won't be an issue because Ian wanted him on turf last out, and it got washed out. And I saw Tommy Vanberg make a similar move last week where a horse who kept getting washed off the turf finally got turf and won. So gonna take a nod from a fellow hard boot and trust Rise the Guy in the opener. And then real quick, Magic Dance, I do think, is by far the most likely winner in the sequence. And will be a heavy, heavy single for me. She was electrifying on debut, and the horse she crushed came back to win yesterday.
Very good. Nice.
So heading to Woodbine, I talked a lot about this last year, actually, with Wonder Godot, but the 14-horse field really exponentially makes it such a better opportunity than even 10 or 11-horse, which is great, but 14 on a day where there's dead money, for lack of a better word, it just really gives you a lot of options and looks if you have the right opinion, and I'm hoping that's the case in the Queen's Plate, where I do think Skywire is the most likely winner for Mark Cassie. Just has the numbers that are better than most of these, coupled with the right running style, Steve. I had a Twitter thread where I looked at the running styles from Brisnet, and forwardly placed is just where you want to be, even at the mound of quarter route. And this horse definitely, with really not a lot of speed in the race, could either go gates of wire or just gets first run on the rest. So I do see Skywire is the most likely winner. I see Tone Broke is a horse who is definitely to fear, but he should take money for Steve Asmussen. But those are the two I'm leaning on heaviest.
Yep, that didn't sound good. I think we just lost Eddie. He's on his way to he's going to meet Tommy Hammer for lunch. So, do you want two choices, Ray? You can try take one quick shot. He dropped. Yeah, give him a quick call back, because rather than switch off, let's vamp for a second. And we'll try to get Eddie right back. That was going swimmingly until it wasn't. anything? Let me take a quick look. Oh, while we got, let me slip this one in as we wait for Ed to come back. The Chicago Handicap tomorrow. You got a very nice card if you haven't looked at Arlington yet. I mean, it's a very good Saturday. I wasn't kidding. You got a good late pick 4. And a late pick 5, you got a second level allowance going a mile at a 16th on the turf. Starts the late pick 5. Fillies and Mares, group of 7. Then Maiden Special going 6 on the Poly. That's a group of 12. Then a first level allowance, full field 12 on the turf a mile. Then comes the Chicago Handicap. And Hotshot Anna, you know, certainly the mare to beat. But there's a couple of horses that are within shouting distance. Ed DeRosa back with us. I was just telling everybody about the Chicago Handicap. Nice card at Arlington tomorrow, too, for those that haven't looked yet.
Sounded like it from what you were saying. I really miss playing Arlington. This spring, summer has been busy, but now's the time to get back to it for sure. So looking forward to that. I'm not sure where I dropped off, but basically in the Queen's Plate, Skywire and Tone Broke are the obvious ones I like. And then Moon Swings and the Kraken horse. I keep wanting to say Release the Kraken. Kraken Wagon, 30 and 50 to 1 respectively, are absolutely two I am using in the mix in the verticals. I just think both have an opportunity with any improvement to crash the number. Maybe they don't win, but if they're behind Skywire or Tone Broke, we're still going to do okay in the 14-horse field.
Very good. How about some of the other stakes?
Yeah, the two preceding or the two I'm most excited about, actually, I think Extravagant Kid is very live, shipping up for Brendan Walsh. I love that he gets one of the locals with the rail post position. I think he has a big chance to upset Caribou just to his outside. Love seeing the Grade 1 turf sprint. A lot of fun, and it's 6-1. I do think Extravagant Kid is a must-use in those multis I talked about before. And then the all-graded stake pick, or not graded stake, all-stake pick 3, starting with the Dance Smartly. I'm going to just try to take advantage of some inefficiencies of the parimutuel market. I think Holy Helena, with her being a Queen's Plate winner, even more of a name up there than Starship Jubilee, who has her own fan club in her own right. But I think they have about an equal chance to win. But I have no doubt Holy Helena is going to take more money. So Starship Jubilee, I'm going to go with a cagey single in a race that I think it's down to those two, and hopefully that allows me to go deeper in a competitive Queen's Plate.
Very good. What else?
That's, I guess, my strongest opinions. I'll shift back. Sounds like we have a little time. Back to Churchill. The finale of that pick six tomorrow, Zip Your Lip, finally gets to stretch out to a mile, and I'm not really sure why they haven't tried. I guess City Zip on top, and maybe the pedigree says sprint, but I think the mile on turf should be no problem for this horse, and they finally get it. So that's definitely a horse I'll be using in the finale, Zip Your Lip at Churchill Downs.
Very good.
Would love to get live to him.
Well, and you're live for lunch, meeting Tommy Hammer. Should be a lot of weight. Where's he taking you?
He's taking me to California Sandwiches, which is a place, I forget which, he took down a bet or won a tournament or what, but I DM'd him and said, what are you doing to celebrate? And he said, I'm going to California Sandwiches for their veal cutlets. So if it's good enough to celebrate a five-figure score, it's good enough for lunch.
I got a feeling you're in for a fun afternoon tying in with Tommy Massis and Ed DeRosa. There's an exacta. Have a terrific plate day. Have a great trip, Ed.
Thanks, Steve. Going to be a lot of fun.
We'll talk in a couple of weeks. We're off next week. I'm taking the week, so we'll talk to you for Saratoga opening. Ed DeRosa, EJXD2, and we'll stay right here. And we've got about a half hour to fill out, and we'll spend it talking about Suffolk and with the Bostonians and New Englanders, including Jessica Chappell, who's going to join us now, and known as Railbird, and always thoughtful, and also if those who saw that picture I used of Tammy Piermarini yesterday, Jessica, a very talented lensman as well, and her photo essays are wonderful. And Jess, this is so bittersweet for everybody. I mean, everybody knew it was coming, and you know, we had these weekends the last several years that Lou Raffetto crafted beautifully. But knowing that it's really going to be over, it's a little different coming into the weekend.
Yes, it is. Thanks, Steve, for having me on. I love talking about my home track, and I'm glad to be part of your appreciations for this last weekend and for Suffolk Downs and its amazing 84-year history. You know, I'm actually a little bit on tears just starting to talk about it with you because, you know, this track has meant so much to so many people over the years, so many people in racing right now as officials and handicappers, trainers, jockeys, you know, just fans and writers like me have come through this place. This is where we, you know, got the bug, you know, got the passion for horse racing. And knowing that this is really, truly going to be the end after, you know, what has been sort of a lucky bit of extension since 2014 and the casino decision, it's just really kind of heartbreaking.
How did you get introduced and proximity? I don't know where you grew up exactly,
yeah.
But how did you get on the, how did you even get interested?
Well, you know, it's kind of funny. This goes back to August 2003 for me. That was the summer of Seabiscuit. And
sure.
My husband, well, at the time, because I had just started dating my now husband, and I had gone to see the movie. And it really reminded me of my grandmother Chappell, who had been a horse racing fan. And when me and my sister were kids, every time we went to visit her, there'd be a day where grandma would take us to the track. And so Seabiscuit actually reminded me of how much I had enjoyed going to the track and, you know, spending time with my grandmother. And I said to this guy I was seeing then, hey, I'd love to go to the track. Is there a track around here we could go to? And yeah, there was Suffolk Downs. I was living in Boston at the time. And I went to Suffolk Downs. And, you know, it was just one of those things where you go and you just immediately, you know, for me, it was just instant. I just sort of was like, what is this world? What have I stumbled into? And, you know, not only sort of past memories of going to the track and having fun, but sort of realizing, you know, the history, the culture, the handicapping, just the sheer fun of trying to figure out races. And so from starting in August 2003, that was when I really began to, you know, first it was just reading everything. And then, of course, I was going to the track all the time. I had returned to school, so I had a student schedule, which was fantastic for making it to the racetrack pretty much every afternoon it was running. And then in 2004, I started writing. I started blogging about horse racing, and I also introduced myself to the person who would become my first mentor, trainer Mauro DiStefano. He was kind of a regular on at Suffolk Downs and the New England tracks and Mid-Atlantic tracks, and he invited me to come by his barn. And I don't think he realized that when he did that, I would take him seriously. And so I did. I started showing up pretty much every day until he put me to work. And that was how I got into it.
You know, your insights and your approach to the sport in general is very thoughtful and sensitive. And as you can tell from just, even explaining your introduction to Suffolk, you must have appreciated immediately that this was or had become, kind of racing's, lower tier and, the hard scrabble atmosphere that not just the track, but East Boston in general,
right.
Feels like something that was really, perfect for you. That you certainly didn't need glitz and a fancy scenario. I keep referring when people ask about Suffolk, and they just assume for some reason that it's that it's a ramshackle or beaten down facility, and that is just so not the case. And everybody that goes is shocked at what a beautiful little oasis it is, in fact, in the neighborhood.
Yeah, I mean, it was so thoughtfully laid out. I mean, it was built in, 65 days? And yet the way it's positioned to really take advantage of the views of the marsh, the way that the infield was laid out is very beautiful, very gracious. The grandstand itself, just there's lovely views from pretty much no matter, where you're looking when you're up there. I mean, I didn't actually really get into the big day racing stuff, that kind of started in 2004, 2005 at the first Kentucky Derby. I remember really caring about. I mean, so for me, it was, I tapped into Suffolk Downs, and for one thing, this really lovely, beautiful place, but also, even at the bottom level, you see thoroughbreds who are so athletic, they're so game, you really see what makes the sport competitive. And, at the time, it was still doing pretty good handles. So, there were decent pools. You could get prices on horses. If you really handicapped the races, you could make money at it. That was pretty great. And then it was just so much of it was also just seeing how much racing is a community and how much the people involved in it, they come to it. Some of them come to it from generations. Their parents, their families have been in this. They've been breeding horses or training horses. For generations, and other people, it's very much this calling, it's a vocation, and you can just see how much, it almost doesn't really matter what level you're talking about or the environment you're in, you just see what this relationship with horses means and what it means to people to be in racing and to live their lives this way, and that's just something that I related to almost instantly. A big part of it for me was I had moved to Boston in 1997 from Minnesota and had spent some time working for some pretty waspy national publications, sort of very different class-wise from what I had known. I came from a very working-class background myself. And so part of it was after sort of years being in these environments, these sort of high wasp environments and trying to fit in there, part of it was just I came to the track and to Suffolk Downs, and there was a little bit of, here's like a way of being and a way of working that I really understand now. And this is something that exists and I can be part of it. And so it kind of allowed me to sort of, merge what I had been doing with sort of my background and my past and find a way to put it all together and do it, in the presence of amazing animals and dedicated people.
You had to, as you got involved and started to visit, and I'm because I know the way you delve into topics, you must have particularly appreciated what a wonderful fountainhead Suffolk had been and became for female riders
and
how important it was as a either as an outlet or as a stepping stone.
Yes, and I think that's something that when tracks like Suffolk Downs close, the industry as a whole really loses out on. So, you know, Suffolk Downs from the late 1960s, and definitely from the 1970s, was one of the places where female riders were welcome to could really get a foothold into racing and build a career. And, you know, even you go, even look at like 2007 to 2014, the last time that there were full meets running, and you look at what's a deep bench of female riders there were. I mean, not just Tammy Piermarini, who was atop the leaderboard for several years running during that period, but, you know, Jill Jellison, Jackie Davis came. There's a whole bunch of others whose names I'm forgetting right now. I'm so sorry. But it has been this place where, yeah, people who might otherwise kind of struggle to get in, you know, say like if they had to go to a track like Belmont or a track like Churchill Downs, they might kind of struggle to get in. And a track like Suffolk Downs, they could really flourish. They could get rides. They could, you know, be recognized for their skill and you know, have a career. And Suffolk Downs has just been, it has been such a source of that for the game. And I think we're really going to, all of us, wherever we are in racing, are going to miss that. And it's sort of potential to be a place where people can come in and, you know, become a vibrant part, a vital part of our game.
For people, Jessica Chappell is joining us. You can follow her as Railbird on Twitter. And also she has several identities. She's a bit of a tiny female Batman. It's just one of our favorite people who's kind of sprightly and just always cheery and has got this inquisitive mind that takes her in all kinds of directions. And you've got all these different online identities and outlets.
Right. And I've recently become a librarian. I just finished library school in January, and so that's like one of my other identities now is librarian archivist.
My God, that's pretty funny.
Yeah, but it all comes back to racing. It always comes back to horses somehow.
we'll have to have. You'll be at Saratoga at some point this summer, yes?
Oh, I will for sure.
All right. Well, we'll get you on there and maybe TV with Seth. I want you to just tell people before we go, Jess, what you'll miss most, and what, you know, for those that aren't going to get a chance to ever visit Suffolk, what they should feel about it.
I think people who have never been to Suffolk should feel the passing of a beautiful urban track, a place where people from all different parts of our city can come together and really enjoy the sport at its, you know, this is in some ways the purest level of the sport, because it's about that everydayness, and it's about, you know, the horses and the relationships that people have with horses, and just the sort of, you know, what most of the time we're going to the track and what we're betting on, you know, these are the races, the claiming races and the allowance races that really make up what we consider our game. And, you know, that's what I'm really going to miss the most. I learned how to handicap on these claiming races and with these, you know, with these old warrior geldings, right? You know, the 9-year-olds, the 7-year-olds, all these horses who would go out and they were pros. And I'm just going to kind of miss that, having a relationship as a fan and a better with those horses and their people, and just sort of being part of this community.
Well, it's one of the racetracks, you know, unending qualities is that it is welcoming. It, you know, it's a place for people who, I don't want to say misfits, but people that don't have necessarily a conventional set of interests or social norms and ties. The racetrack is a catch-all. And
it is. But that also makes it such... Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, that's like what makes it such a democratic space, and I feel increasingly that those are rarer in our society.
Yep.
It's a place where you can just sort of get jumbled up with all kinds of other people and sort of bump up against each other in a way that in a lot of ways we just can't anymore. So, yeah, it is kind of a catch-all place, but it's also this democratic space, and it's a special place.
Well, and particularly in a town like Boston, a unique and invaluable role, and it won't be. We certainly know one thing: it will not be replaced within the hub. That part we know. It may manifest itself out in the countryside, and that would be charming, but. The unique charm of Suffolk Downs will not be replicated. That's for sure.
No, I very much hope that the Great Barrington Plan comes off, but Suffolk Downs is unique, and we will miss it when it's gone.
Jessica Chappell, Railbird, everybody on Twitter. Jess, I'm delighted to have you join us for this.
Thanks so much, Steve. It was great talking with you.
Always. Jessica Chappell, folks, we're going to stay right here, and chances are we'll close out the weekend preview and the first half of the broadcast year with another veteran and alumni from Suffolk Downs, and Larry Comus, one of the places that on his journey, like so many race callers, make so many different stops, and Larry became a very familiar voice and the voice of Suffolk. And he joins us now. Larry, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. You want Suffolk stories? What do we have? 3-4 hours to talk?
we've had 6 hours and I could obviously do. And I suppose during the summer at Saratoga, I'll cycle through everybody that comes through. That's got a connection. We'll give them a chance to make the appreciation, but yeah, that's exactly the case.
It's there's so many, you know. The place closed down obviously in 1989. I'm sure you've discussed that by now. And when we reopened in 1992, I was the first guy to call the races, and it was January 1st, 1992. I'll never forget. It was 65 degrees that day on January 1st in Boston. Right? Impossible. It snowed the next day, of course. But one of my favorite stories is getting into the press box after calling the first race, which, by the way, was won by a horse named Larry of Florida with Rudy Baez in the saddle. I remember it well. And I got it. I went down to the press box to get lunch, right? And the topic of conversation was the new announcer guy. So nobody knew what I looked like. I was 25 years old. I was just a kid. And there was a crotchety old reporter named Ed Duckworth, who was the Providence Journal guy, and he always chomped on these smelly cigars. He was a great guy. I loved him. But anyway, he said the line that when he said it, I knew how much I would love New England and living in the area, because they were talking about the new announcer who was replacing Jim Hannon, who was there for 20 years. And Ed Duckworth said, "All I can say is that all change is bad." And I just started, I had to come up and introduce myself to him. And, you know, I said, I love that line. That's a great line. And I knew that right there I would love the place. And ended up spending, 15, 16 years there, you know, between going back and forth with Monmouth in the summer. Because, you know, Suffolk was a winter track. Hard to believe in Boston, but it was for years. And it was just. So many people I met up there. I don't think there's been another place of all the places I've worked where I have more friends now, lifelong friends, than from that place. It just was just incredible.
And that period, and I didn't even realize that you were there that long. I'm amazed that it was that kind of a period. I thought it was a much briefer window.
Yeah, like 15 years. I got there in 92. And then, you know, was sort of going back and forth with TD, and I would split things, TD Thornton, and I would split things, you know, in like 07 and 08, before it just got to be too much of an overlap. And Chip Tuttle said, you know, this is not going to work anymore. I'm like, yeah, I know, I'm killing myself. I was literally calling Suffolk on Mondays and Tuesdays and Monmouth Wednesday through Sunday for a while. But I wanted to keep coming back because I love Boston so much. One other story, just, because I know that you're up against the clock, I'm sure, but the opposite end of the spectrum, the day of Suffolk Downs that I'm sure others have talked about, but that I'll never forget, and it's something that couldn't happen anywhere else, especially at a big track. And it was when Cigar came back and won the MASCAP for the second time in 1996. He had won it in 95, and then, of course, he was became the horse of the world. He kept winning and winning and winning, and then he won the Dubai World Cup, and our boss back then, Lou Raffetto, went to Dubai to make sure he'd come back to Boston and join us at the MASCAP. And I always remember the words that Jim Mosley, the owner of the track, said back when we first opened in 1992. He said, "The best horses in the world will be here in Boston." And everybody was like, "Yeah, right. That's never going to happen, right?" So if you know Suffolk Downs, at the very top of the stretch is where the barn area is. And the horses come from there, and they make their way down the stretch to the paddock, which is in front of the building, sort of like it is at Aqueduct. So here comes Cigar. It's about 25 minutes to post time for the MASCAP, looking for his 15th straight win. So here he comes, and you can hear in the distance, you can see all the backstretch workers back there have assembled, and you can hear them applaud. And as he gets closer, you hear the applause get louder. And as he gets closer, it gets louder and louder and louder and louder. And then to the point where the entire building is shaking. It is absolutely shaking at 25 minutes to post time for the MASCAP, because everyone was so amazed that this horse, the greatest horse in the world, was right there at a track that basically had a lot of $4,000 claiming races, you know. And it was just, I get choked up thinking about it, Steve. It was just the most incredible moment. I remember a little kid on the rail with a sign that said, "I love you, Mr. Cigar." You know, just all this stuff. And you're like, "Oh my God, I have to call this race in 25 minutes. I'm putting my head down, you know, on the desk, trying to compose myself, and I'm like, this is, I've never seen anything like this." And you'll never see anything like that. You'll never see that at Belmont or Saratoga or Santa Anita or Keeneland, because they expect to see those big horses. When those horses go to tracks like that, it's 1,000 times bigger of a deal, and I'll never, ever forget that moment.
Yeah, and that's sweet. And in fact, I know that when you and I have talked about those occasions that you've gone to Charlestown, and that it has that similar atmosphere, the big name jocks and the big horses that come in for the classic. And I've been to one, and I can sort of sense exactly, you know, what you're referencing.
Yeah, I mean, the crowd was like, I think our attendance was 23,000, which, you know, doesn't sound like a lot, but in that place it is. It's just, that's packed to the rafters. You know, it's just completely as full as it could possibly be. And, you know, we had the police escort come and get him from the airport, and, you know, then made the front page of the Boston Globe and Herald. And it was just such a big deal, you know, back then. And you know, when we first opened in 92, it was like, you know, how long is this place going to make it? And, you know, we made it up until this weekend.
Exactly. Wow. Larry, I wanted to make sure you were a part of this. We're going to close out our Suffolk appreciations with Mike Welsh. And, of course, another nice weekend coming here at Belmont, and then Stars and Stripes in Saratoga. And we'll see you and talk to you at the spa. And I appreciate this visit.
Absolutely. I wish I could be in Boston this weekend, but I will. I look forward to seeing you at Saratoga. And there's so many Boston people that come to Saratoga that say, "I remember you from Suffolk Downs, baby. You've come a long way." And it makes you feel great.
Well, and it's great to hear from Larry, and we'll stay right here for our last 7, 8, 9 minutes. Mike Welsh standing by, who basically cut his teeth on New England racing coverage that is, you know, having been a native, obviously, of the area. He's been removed from New England for a while. But, Mike, you got to tie up all the loose ends here and you know, give Suffolk the send-off it deserves.
Well, I don't know what loose ends there were leading up to this. But look, it was a terrific place. All New England racing when I was there was just fun. I mean, it was just a different kind of era too, you know. But the Gansett and Lincoln and all the fairs. But Suffolk had great riders, great trainers, great racing. Then it morphed into Rockingham Park in the summer times, which of course was even better as far as the guys that would come in at Rockingham Park. But New England had its characters. We had its stories, not all that could be told in the air, but it was certainly a great place to kind of grow up in racing. It's where I really got my start with the racing form, you know, first taking the call and then calling charts around the whole area there. But Eli Chiat was my mentor, and he was a legend himself back there as a chart caller, and just went on from there. But what can I say? Just a terrific, terrific place, and it'll be sad when it's gone.
Where did you grow up in proximity to the track?
Well, I actually grew up in New York, and I went to school at Boston University. That's how I wound up, you know, at Suffolk Downs. I was at Suffolk Downs many times before I started working there. I had some roommates in college. One of them had a nephew that worked at the track, and, you know, we kind of started going to the races. That was back in the day when Suffolk only ran from April. They actually started on Patriots Day, and they ran up until Rockingham opened in the summer, and then I think maybe came back with a short meet, and the rest of the time it was Rhode Island. It was a true circuit then, and then, you know, a few years later, they were all running on top of each other, running year-round. But, you know, I went to school in Boston at Boston University. And that's how I wound up, you know, getting my job at the racing form and starting at Suffolk and Rockingham.
Having what year? I mean, what was the
70s, mid 70s?
Wow.
And then on from there. Yeah, long time ago. But
and when did you leave? When did you end up?
93 was my last year. 93, they thought the racing there was going kind of, you know, downhill, or had been minor league for a while. I remember Suffolk closed for a couple of years back in the late 80s, reopened again, and the form decided to limit their coverage there. So they wanted me to go to New York and take over. I think Fran LaBelle was in New York at the time. They wanted me to take over in New York at that time. And I was just, you know, I really didn't want to go into New York. I had a wife and two kids, and I heard the Florida job was opening up, that the Florida corresponding with Jack Smallwood at the time was retiring. So I asked if I could go to Florida instead, and they said I could, but I had to spend one winter in New York in 93, which was just supposed to be January and February, and that morphed into they couldn't find anybody else to go in there, so I stayed until Derby Day, and then went home, jumped in the car, drove to Florida, called her open the end of May or May 20th, and that's when I started, May 20th, 1993, here in Florida.
How about that? This weekend at Florida.
Sea Hero. That was my last day in New York. I remember betting Sea Hero with the Derby that year, 93.
Good work. Look at you. Nicely done.
They got me some gas money to get down to Florida.
I love it. Some of the personalities, Mike, that made Suffolk and the New England scene special, the ones that stay with you when you think of Suffolk.
Well, I remembered some of Jim Hannon's calls. There were Quayton brought Brush in the mass cap that year. Of course, we had Cigar came in for the mass cap. You know, just some of the riders that I got to know and be around. That when the McCarrans started out, they were there.
Sure.
Pretty much starting out when I was starting out. Chris, I think, was a Bug Boy then. So I've known Chris for a long time when he was back there. You know, like I said, Eli Chiat, who was my mentor calling charts, he was a great Bruins fan, and not only a Bruins fan, but he actually lived down the street from Bob Johnson, who coached and then was general manager of the team. And one of our regular visitors almost every day at Suffolk when they were in town and around was Jerry Cheevers. So I got to meet Jerry and got to go to a few games and get some insights on hockey, and that, you know, never left me. I mean, I was kind of a hockey fan when I got there from growing up in New York. I was a Rangers fan back then, but became a Bruins fan pretty quickly when Jerry was around. So, and he was quite a character too. I mean, he was he owned horses. Obviously, he had Royal Ski, and so that was fun being up there. I was just a kid then, and to be around guys like that almost every day, when he would come out was fun. And then the great trainers, Vinnie Blenge, who's still around here. So you'll see Vinnie every now and then out at the track. Bobby DeStacio is the racing secretary. He's still around here. See him from time to time around here. So, and a lot of the guys that cut their teeth in New England went on to some pretty big things with both riders and trainers.
Well, and I've mentioned, some of the names. Mike Arrow was on with us yesterday. We couldn't reach Ned Allard, unfortunately, but Jay Bernardini and Bobby
Bona,
right?
Yeah, they were kind of the later group. Yeah, they were kind of the later group after I had left. It was just, Bernardini was still there. I mean, Ned was there, though. He was like one of the mainstays. John Rigatieri, Charlie Asimakopoulos, those were the main guys. And along with Vinny, when I was around there, Ron Dandy and the Generazios, I got to know the Generazios back then. They had some really good horses with Ron Dandy, and now still friends with them, still see them. They're still big in the business. So,
sure.
They got their start back there. So the Rob Shams, Rob, they're gone. But
good job, Rob Sham.
The Rob Shams kind of got into the business through the Generazios, and we know the legacy that they left and the success they had over the years as well. So, it was just a great place to be, and just being in Boston. Working there and being so close to Fenway and going to Fenway and Harvey Pack too. I used to do the TV shows there on the local cable station, and we bring Harvey in every Mass Cap Day, and we do a special hour show on the station. We preceded the Celtic games on the cable station back then. And,
how great!
We had Harvey would come in, and he was very popular guy back then with the fans. Obviously, even in Boston, even though he was a New York guy, he'd come in and he drew a huge crowd every year when we'd have him up there, for our little seminar before the races.
I love it. Picking
the horses. So that was great then too.
Well, a perfect ending to a couple of days worth of appreciations. A Suffolk will be there tomorrow and Sunday to say goodbye, and Mike will be
on a coast. I'm dying to go up there on Sunday. I got to be here Saturday for the Summit of Speed, and then I'm flying up to New York Sunday morning, and then was thinking of maybe driving the bus before going to Saratoga, but just not going to be able to do it.
I'll say goodbye for you, and Mike, I appreciate it. And as Mike mentions, Summit of Speed tomorrow at Gulfstream, the three-year-olds and the Smile, and the fillies and mares and the Rooney, and the other three races. The Sunday pick six got quashed with a $3 million winner yesterday.
Unbelievable. You talk about this place having bad luck when it comes to those things.
Well,
I mean, that cost probably $12 million in handle on Sunday with that ticket. Still trying to find out where
who was. Yeah, we're anxious to hear. Mike Welch, everybody. And I want to thank Mike and Lou Raffetto and Jessica and Larry Colmus, as well as everybody else, Marty McGee and Matt Hegarty, Don Lupel and Nick Tamaro. Best of luck this weekend. Don Winfrey, too. Talk to you Monday. Or actually 2 weeks.